This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hi there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Greetings.
We're going to start today by looking at a few of the early decisions being made by the Joe Biden administration. We'll look at his first foreign policy speech, where he announced a decision to pull America out of one theater that will create a significant vacuum. But first, President Biden's orders regarding energy production in America and the far-reaching implications these decisions will have. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew.
Yeah, Joe Biden's been signing executive orders in a fury, 28 official ones in his first 2 weeks in office, more than any other president before. And at least two of them had far-reaching implications for American energy independence. One is that he revoked the permit allowing America to build the Keystone XL pipeline, or at least for that pipeline to cross the border into Canada. And two, he banned all, actually, like fracking and other oil exploration from federal lands. And so just on the immediate job front, that killing that Keystone pipeline kills 11,000 well-paying jobs. Mm-hmm. And the American Petroleum Institute estimates that banning oil exploration on federal lands, because 13% of all our oil comes from federal lands, will probably cost us about 1 million jobs by next year.
That is shocking.
So that one doesn't kick in as fast as the 11,000 that are just gone, but just the ripple effects that, like, by 2022, it's like 1 million people who can't work in the oil industry. Mm-hmm. And so just that alone just shows how devastating these two orders can be for the economy.
You know, it also shows you just how effective the Trump administration was. This was a big story, the fact that America actually became so self-sufficient energy-wise, and not just self-sufficient, but actually became a significant energy exporter under his administration with a few key decisions and just reducing some of the restrictions on energy that had been there in place before him. But, you know, it's amazing how much turns on just a couple of executive orders.
Right, yeah, just you ban the federal lands, there's 13% of your energy capacity right there. And then you ban this pipeline, and that'll have huge implications down the road, because America produces more than half of the oil it uses, but our biggest, by far our biggest partner, that where we buy oil from, is Canada. We buy about, of the oil we import, we buy about half of it from Canada. And so when you start nixing pipelines like this, you make it harder to get oil from Canada, especially harder to get more oil than you're already from, which makes you still reliant on the other nations we get oil from, maybe even have to get more oil from those nations. And those aren't nations like Canada. That's like, well, just going down the list, Canada's our top oil importer. But after that is Mexico, then Saudi Arabia, then Russia, then Colombia, Iraq, Ecuador.
Wow.
You have to get down to about 14th before you get to Venezuela. But these are countries that aren't nearly as friendly to us as Canada is.
Right.
Which makes it concerning. This is actually a statement from Tuesday from Senator Joe Manchin, who's a Democrat from West Virginia. So not necessarily a conservative bastion in American politics. But even he slammed Joe Biden for killing the Keystone pipeline. He said it was a knee-jerk reaction that's really going to hurt us. I have a quote from him. Here's the quote. It says, "The bottom line is that I'm an all-in energy person, and we have to have energy basically and not be dependent on foreign energy. So we have to have the heavy crude, and I'd rather get it from Canada than we would from Venezuela." Mm-hmm. And like I said, right now we were only getting about 1% of our oil imports from Venezuela. And I know of, the Biden administration hasn't announced plans to increase that. But Joe Manchin's just pointing it out. It's like, we have so much oil that we need. If you're nixing the 13% that we get from our federal lands and nixing the pipelines that allow us to get it from Canada, we're going to have to get it from someplace else, which is likely going to be Mexico, Saudi Arabia, Russia, Venezuela, one of those countries.
Right. Joe Manchin also made the point about this aspect of foreign energy dependence is absolutely huge. It's a game-changing decision. But even by virtue of their efforts to advocate for clean energy, a pipeline is the cleanest possible way of transporting oil that you can have. And Joe Manchin made that point that when you have trucks that are having to transport oil, that's a far more dangerous and potentially hazardous or toxic kind of a problem that you're dealing with than going through pipelines. It seems like this is one of those kind of virtue signaling decisions that actually undermines the overarching goals that they're reaching for.
Right. It is something that you hear liberals talk about all the time, like, pipelines leak sometimes and they're bad for the government, for the environment. And like, okay, yeah, I mean, they have leaked it sometimes, but then you have to consider, what are your alternatives? Because I don't think any of these liberal environmentals, not many of them, are actually talking about using less energy in their personal lives. There's like, we still have to have the energy from someplace.
Yeah.
And if you don't use a pipeline, then you have to use a truck or a ship from Venezuela,
yeah,
which like an oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico from a ship that has an accident or a leak from a truck is far more devastating and far more common than comes with pipelines. So like Joe Manchin's right. It's like the pipelines, despite them not being perfect for the environment, are about the best technology known to man to allow us to use fossil fuels while minimizing the damage to the environment.
Not to mention that ships and trucks require gas to operate.
Right.
Yeah. So a million job loss in the United States, more dependence on foreign nations for our energy. The ramifications of these decisions is really far-reaching.
Right. Yeah. Definitely a huge hit to the economy. And then probably the bigger thing is just the long term is the amount we have to depend on foreign nations. Our editor in chief, he's pointed so many times to even like how the enemy is using the Seagates. Seagates are prophesied to use Seagates against America to choke off their energy, which that's something that like a pipeline to Canada helps mitigate against, because you don't need to rely on Seagates to get oil if you're producing it domestically or getting it from Canada. But then you start getting it from Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, Colombia. Now all of a sudden these gates like the Panama Canal and the Yucatan Channel and the Straits of Florida that become like even more significant than they already are, because you need them for your energy.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, one of the books we'll put in the show notes is a book we've advertised so many times, America Under Attack, that Mr. Gerald Flory wrote in 2012. But he's got a section in there. It's on page 9, the subheading Satan's Second Target, where he describes that the Bible describes the church as spiritual Israel, and when Satan was cast down in the end time, he immediately went after spiritual Israel. That was his first target. But then he goes on to say that like Satan's second target is physical Israel, or the United States and Britain. And that's really the only way you can make sense of some of these decisions. I mean, sometimes like a Democrat makes a decision and I immediately try to start get into like, well, what's their point of view? That's occasionally you make a decision that like if you build on a faulty logical foundation, it's like, okay, well, I don't agree with that, but I can see what they're doing. But something like this, it's like Joe Manchin said, it's like it hurts our energy independence and it hurts the environment, mm-hmm, and it hurts their kind of, there is no upside to this. It's not a political horse trading. There's no upside to this decision. It's just a satanic attack on America and a support for its enemies.
Yeah.
And so it's like, as outside from that spiritual dimension, I can't even see how they're reasoning through this.
Mm-hmm. America Under Attack, that booklet has fresh relevance now with a Biden administration in power. We thank you very much for that, Andrew. We'll link to that booklet in our show notes. You can find that there under the literature tab on thetrumpet.com as well. Now to the foreign policy sphere, we got a look at the Biden administration's first concrete measures regarding foreign military intervention. For this, we'll turn to Brenton Octagal.
Yes, this week, Mr. Biden gave his first speech relating to foreign policy, and he chose to single out Yemen as one location where there is going to be a new level of focus for America. Particularly, he has decided that Saudi Arabia is not going to be able to access any of America's weapons anymore that were related or would be used, or no, there'll be no forthcoming sales to Saudi Arabia for weapons that they wanted to use in the battle for Yemen. And this is kind of interesting because the last couple of moves by the Trump administration were to really empower the Saudis for the battle for Yemen and to really curtail Iran's strength in Yemen by designating the Houthis, which are the Iranian-backed group that took over Yemen at the end of 2014, as a terrorist organization. And so the Biden administration is coming in saying, well, no, we're going to look at this terrorist designation of the Houthis. We don't believe that's accurate. They're saying that there is going to be a lack of humanitarian aid that is going to be able to come into the country because of that designation. And so they're probably going to bring that back down or rescind that. And at the same time, they've decided to then neuter Saudi Arabia's ability to fight back against the Houthis in Yemen as well by this decree by Mr. Biden.
One aspect of a Biden presidency that we expected to see was this pro-Iranian position. He certainly advocated for that under the Obama administration. Now he's at the helm, and this is exactly what we would expect to see. It does favor Iran, this decision.
Yeah, and I mean, he has chosen, I guess, some low-hanging fruit, they would say, at least to get some support from Republicans on this decision, since the Senate is kind of against the Yemen war because it has gone on for 5 years. And so he's chosen to curtail Saudi Arabia's strength through this. But ostensibly, it is helping out the Iranians. Michael Doron, he heads up the Hudson Institute. He just wrote in the Wall Street Journal an article on February 4th. In the Middle East, Biden returns to abnormal, basically saying that the Biden administration's decrees, and this, and he talks about this, how it is continuing on the Obama era foreign policy, which sought to reward America's adversary, which is Iran, at the expense of its relationships with its allies, which has been the Gulf and Israel. And we, as he brings out in that piece, and as we've drawn attention to for decades, how did this all begin in Yemen? This began in 2014 as a response to the Arab Spring, where the Obama administration strengthened populist movements to throw down strongmen that were ruling over their Islamic populations. And we saw it happen in Egypt with that nation falling, Mubarak falling, and the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood. Shortly thereafter, we saw the Yemen chaos that continued because of the rise of the Houthis. The Houthis are a Shiite, follow Shiite Islam. They're one of the major, I would say, pockets of Shia that exists in the Middle East. And so it makes sense for Iran to jump on board with them and to fund them and to direct them to expand their power. And so they took over the capital, Sana'a, back in 2014, and the Houthis did. And it was a month or less than a month later when Iran comes out and says, we are the new sultans of the Red Sea. Mm-hmm. Iran was the one, was the nation that said, this is a victory for us. A Houthis victory is an Iranian victory. That's what led to the Saudis being involved in this war. It was to counteract Iran taking over its southern border, And what have we seen for the past 5 years? It is missiles and drones with increasing ability being fired on Saudi Arabian cities, whether it's Jeddah on the Red Sea, oil facilities being attacked by suicide boats. We've seen Iran through the Houthis mine the Bab al-Mandab Strait, which is the main choke point of ocean-bound transit that goes up through the Red Sea from the Indian Ocean to the Mediterranean. Before it goes to the Suez, it has to go through the Bab al-Mandab. And Iran has said, we control that. And so that's why Saudi Arabia got involved, to try and stop another capital in the Middle East falling to the Iranians. And now the Biden administration gets in and says, well, no, we're supporting the Houthis in this by extension, by cutting off arms from Saudi Arabia and cutting off U.S.'s ability to rearm and participate in some of these missions like they were against the Houthis.
Well, really, you could have seen America's involvement in the whole affair there as the Trump administration's recognition that it was imperative to limit Iran's influence there.
Yeah, this is dangerous for the entire world. Iran has said, I mean, Iran tells us what they want. They said they took it over so they could control the Red Sea passageway. That's what they wanted to do. They said they were in charge. They called themselves the gatekeeper. So that's what they wanted to do. The Trump administration was trying to stop that, to curtail Iran's rise, understandably so. And the Biden administration's going back in bed with Iran right now. And the connection between the Houthis and Iran is very clear. As much as the mainstream media would like to play it down, I mean, we've written at length on this. We have an article, Iran, the Source of Houthi Power. It was written last year, and it documents all the relationship, these relationships between the Houthis and Iran. I mean, they're trained by the IRGC. The Houthi group is Iran's attempt to create Hezbollah inside Yemen, to have a state within a state, and they want it for their wretched purposes. And
right, and if there was any question about that earlier on, Iran has made it abundantly clear over the last couple of years that that's exactly what's going on. There's absolutely no question about that.
Yeah, for sure. Although, there is going to be there's going to be rejoicing in American media. There has been this week over this decision. This is a humanitarian crisis, and it is. And there's, I mean, the mass starvation, it is horrible. But you have to get back to the original cause. The cause is Iran backed a takeover of the elected government, and Saudi Arabia tried to stop that. And now the Biden administration, I guess, is all for Iran's power being expanded into the Red Sea. And we know from biblical prophecy that Iran is going to dominate the Red Sea. And now with the Trump administration out of office for a time, maybe we are going to see a strengthening of Iran's stranglehold over that southern gateway to the Red Sea passage.
Well, we will link to that article, Iran, the Source of Houthi Power, in the show notes for the program. I'll also direct our listeners to the first chapter of a booklet that our editor-in-chief has put together, Germany's Secret Strategy to Destroy Iran. And the first part of that is called Iran Gets a Stranglehold on the Middle East. And it specifically talks about this Red Sea strategy that Iran has been building over some time. When you look at what prophecy says about what Iran is going to do there, you can see very much that it is targeting all of the countries that surround that Red Sea and that will enable it to implement exactly the kind of plans that Brent was talking about there. Germany's Secret Strategy to Destroy Iran. Go check that out at thetrumpet.com. We thank you very much for that, Brent. Another point President Biden made in his first foreign policy speech was to call on Russia to release Vladimir Putin's number one opposition figure from prison, where he was sent this week. We'll look at this story next. And for this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, Russian President Vladimir Putin dealt a major blow this week to his main political opposition. This is a man named Alexei Navalny, and a Moscow court on Monday sentenced him to 2 years and 8 months of prison time at a remote penal colony. So the court says that the reason for this sentence is that back in 2014, Navalny was convicted of committing extortion, and most of his sentence back then was suspended, with a requirement that he show up to regular probation appointments. Well, in the second half of 2020, Navalny did not show up for these probation appointments. So the court says that he's in violation of the terms, and now he has to serve this time doing hard labor in a, you know, a remote part of Mordovia or maybe somewhere in Siberia. So that may sound, you know, reasonable enough. He had a suspended sentence, and he didn't show up, so now he's off to the gulags. But the first grave injustice here is that the original case back in 2014 was entirely trumped up. The European Court of Human Rights actually studied this, and they ruled that those charges against Navalny were politically motivated. He had not extorted anyone, but he was an outspoken critic of Putin's government. And so because of that, Putin was basically just punishing him with these trumped up charges. So that's the first big injustice. The second one is even more egregious, and that is that the reason why Navalny failed to make his probation appointments last year is because he was on his deathbed in Germany after Putin's regime had poisoned him. So, you know, Navalny almost died from that poisoning. It happened back in August, and he was poisoned with a nerve agent. That's something that only someone in the upper echelons of the Russian government would have access to. So that shows that Putin was behind it. And, you know, Navalny ended up recovering after months in the hospital there in Germany, but he obviously couldn't attend his probation appointments during that time. He was in a coma for most of it. So the fact that he's now being imprisoned by Putin because he was poisoned by Putin, you know, it's just, it would be funny if it weren't so tragic, but it is tragic. This is a 44-year-old man. He's a husband and a father, and he seems to be, you know, to have integrity. He loves his country, but now he's going to be sentenced to, or sent into this notoriously abusive and inhumane penal colony system. And it's also tragic in a broader sense, because it shows that the people of Russia are living in a dictatorship. I've been corresponding with some contacts there this week, and the mood is just very bleak after this sentencing. One man I spoke with said that the main point in jailing Navalny was not so much about punishing him as it is about sabotaging the opposition's future. You know, so it looks like this does deal a debilitating blow to the opposition. It means that Russia is now very much a one-party state. Even if the government kind of pretends to allow opposition parties to exist, as soon as one of those parties begins to grow powerful enough to pose an actual threat to Putin, the way Navalny's party did, then Putin will use his power to stamp them out.
Yeah, we have been talking about these fairly strong protests that have been taking place in Russia. This is exactly what the people of Russia that are rising up against Putin are fearful of and pushing back against. But Putin doesn't seem to have any compunction about displaying exactly the kinds of authoritarian measures that they hate so much.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, many Russians are deeply disturbed by what they're seeing. We spoke, as you said, about how the fact that even before Navalny was sentenced, just after he'd been arrested, there were two consecutive weekends of some of the largest protests that have hit Russia in recent memory. And let me see, last weekend there were 6,000 people arrested. The weekend before that it was 3,700. And this weekend it'll almost certainly be even more. But ultimately it's still too few people to really affect any change. There were about 100,000 out last weekend, but Russia has a population of 144 million. And two-thirds of them still mostly support Putin. But I think Putin also understands that, yes, in the short term, sending Navalny off to, you know, the gulag, so to speak, that'll fan the opposition sentiment and it'll cause some protests. But in the long term, Navalny's absence from the political scene will probably cause the movement that he built to slowly degrade. So probably in the long term, it is a shrewd move for Putin.
In America right now, we're dealing with this this political crisis caused by a fraudulent election, and we're seeing the restriction of freedom of speech and that type of thing. And in some ways, this is stories like what's happening in Russia should be more relevant than ever to people who are watching what's going on there, because in many ways, what Russians are experiencing is much closer to the norm historically and in nations around the world than what Americans have had up until very recent times. But you see this expression of human nature so often in governments across the globe. What's happening in Russia, it's really a cautionary tale that everyone should be concerned about.
I think so too, yes. And it's not just in Russia. You know, right now the whole world is experiencing, a return to authoritarianism. We actually devoted a special issue of our print edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet to this back in January of 2018. And our executive editor, Mr. Stephen Fleury, wrote the lead article for that. And he talks quite a bit about Vladimir Putin in that article, but he also talks about the Chinese strongman, Xi Jinping. He talks about Erdogan and Turkey and several others. Mm-hmm. And then he writes, "This is the 21st century. We thought we were too modern for this. Yet here it is, a new age of strongmen. And many of these strongmen are beginning to wield their power." And then he goes on to say, "This global trend is actually prophesied in your Bible. Thousands of years ago, the Bible foretold of our day when the world would revert to a more barbaric time of authoritarian rule that leads to war." And, from there, he shows that many end-time Bible prophecies talk about kings being the heads of various geopolitical blocks. We see that mostly in the books of Daniel and Revelation. Also, Ezekiel talks about a prince. And Mr. Fleury explains that Vladimir Putin is one of these kings. He's actually the primary king of the prophesied Eastern Alliance. So when we see Putin becoming, more dictatorial, getting rid of his opposition like Alexei Navalny in order to tighten his grip, that's really perfectly in line with these passages. And we should expect Putin and other rulers to keep on growing more dictatorial and for that trend to eventually lead to just a seismic global clash.
Well, we do appreciate you bringing that to us, Jeremiah. Jeremiah has an article that he's working on this subject. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com next week. And in the meantime, we will link to Stephen Fleury's article, "The New Strongman Age," in the show notes for the program today if you want more prophetic context for that story. The government of Italy recently collapsed. Now a solution has been put forward that promises to bring Italy very much back under the rule of the European Union establishment. To learn about this, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, we've had the return of a figure that used to be a big deal on the news maybe a decade or so ago, but has very much faded from the scene. Mario Draghi, the former head of the European Central Bank. Mr. Draghi was kind of credited for stepping in and saving, or at least temporarily saving, Europe during the Eurozone crisis. He kind of promised a big bazooka of measures to do whatever it would take to keep the euro alive. He persuaded the European Central Bank to put up with a certain amount of money printing. And now he has been invited in to save Europe as well. So we talked before about the government falling apart. Matteo Renzi, somebody who's fairly similar to Draghi in that they're very pro-European Italians, he caused the collapse of the government. We speculated a bit about what could happen. I have to confess, this was not something that was on my radar at all, where the president called in Draghi to put together a government. Now, this doesn't mean that he is definitely Italy's next prime minister. Now he has got to work with the different Italian parties and try and put together a coalition. He doesn't have to have even a majority. The way Italy's constitution currently works is if you can get close to a majority, around 40%, then you kind of get boosted the rest of the way to have enough seats in the House. Even so, this is not necessarily a done deal. Italy is tremendously Eurosceptic, and the Eurosceptic parties did very well last election. Right. So it's not going to be simple for him to get together and negotiate and get together a government, but it's still possible. And, there's a lot of pressure to compromise, to be in office. There's quite a bit of evidence that voters don't want an election in the middle of a coronavirus panic right now, so that somebody may be popular, but if they force an election, if they end up getting the blame for having an election in the middle of a pandemic and all of the paralysis of government that follows, they could lose a lot of votes. So he's got a shot, and we could well see him as the next prime minister of Italy.
Yeah, you said that Mario Draghi has been kind of out of the headlines for a while. I think for trumpet readers, anyone who's been around for a while and followed the trumpet for years immediately is reminded of Ron Fraser, the late Ron Fraser, and how much he wrote about Draghi. He was very struck by this man's policies, his economic policies. To see him back in the news here definitely brings to mind those articles that Ron Fraser wrote about it.
That's right. That's something I went and looked back on pretty quickly after seeing his name there. One of those articles, for example, was called Europe, Enter the Dragon. And he called him in there the Jesuit-trained Vatican supporter, talking about just how closely his views have often aligned with the Catholic Church. And then he also wrote in there, it is of interest in this context to note that the man possesses a Christian name that literally means war, warring, or warlike, Mario. But the surname also intrigues, Draghi, meaning dragon. Interesting to think on. So a man whose name, I guess, means a warlike dragon, definitely does. I mean, it may not be significant, but it definitely does call to mind some of those prophecies in the Book of Revelation about this European power being led to war by the dragon. Not referring to Mario Draghi in those prophecies, of course, but that's the connection Mr. Fraser was making there. So it is very interesting to see him there. That connection with the Catholic Church is something that Mr. Fraser did really zoom into, and in Italian politics especially, politicians often do, have links, certainly talk their policies through with the Catholic Church. The Church wields much more political influence than we're kind of used to churches wielding in the Western world. So I think the amount of attention, everything that Mr. Fraser focused on and how much he did to kind of build this Europe, this monetary union in Europe, to push for European financial regulation to be the standard all the way around the world. That's another thing that kind of came from his tenure at the head of the ECB, and to really try and push for a global dominated or a European financial system to dominate the world, which is something the Catholic Church has talked about quite a lot recently. Andrew Miller has an article in the Trumpet Print, the latest Trumpet Print magazine, that talks about that. So you can see how his policies still do align with what the Pope is doing and with the Catholic Church. So very interesting to watch and to see if he does get in power, where that's going to lead Italy.
Italy's problems are very deep. And for anyone stepping into that role, they're going to face some serious hurdles and challenges. Can you kind of give us a sense of the size and the scope of the job that would be facing the next prime minister, be it Draghi or whoever else?
Yeah. I think Draghi in particular could lead potentially to some massive crises in Italy and Italian politics. And what you have had in Italy is a sense over the last 10 years or so, they very much disagree with the way Europe has handled the bailout fund, and those disagreements have been steamrolled. You had Silvio Berlusconi, who wanted to defy what the European Central Bank wanted to do in terms of Italy's spending plans, and he was basically removed in a coup orchestrated by the European Central Bank. They wrote a letter, if you get rid of this guy or we're going to cut off funding, Italy had no choice. And a pro-EU politician was just parachuted in there, despite the will of the people and despite what the elected representative wanted. With that background, in the last election, you had anti-European parties do phenomenally well. Between the two of them, the one left wing, one right wing anti-European party absolutely dominated the votes, and those two won a majority of the votes. Now you've gotten to the point the left-wing party has kind of compromised a little bit with Europe. The anti-European right wing are getting very close to having a majority in Italy, that you could have an out. Italy's always coalition government. You could, in the next election, you could have an outright anti-European right-wing government ruling Italy. So with this backdrop, with this massive dissatisfaction with Europe, to once again have a pro-EU politician, not any pro-EU politician, but Mario Draghi, who is the pinnacle of European and Brussels establishment, even though he's an Italian, parachuted in there in a collapse of a coalition that was brought about by somebody who had the support of only 2% of the population against a prime minister that had the support of 40%. You could see how if Mario Draghi does get in, this could just fuel this dissatisfaction with Europe and Europe's current direction within Italy even further. And that you could the Quitterly movement, the movement of getting Britain out of, I prefer that to Italexit, but this movement to get Italy out of the euro could only intensify. And this could really push, so this could push Italy, push all of Europe further into catastrophe. And I think that's something that's really interesting to watch. And it just, this is one of many ways the story ties into an article Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flory wrote over the summer, something that we have come back to a few times over the last few weeks, but I think it's never more relevant than right now, and that is coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire. In that article, he wrote, one of the most important effects of the global pandemic over COVID-19 has been almost overlooked. Europe's response to the pandemic is accelerating the fulfillment of one of the most crucial end-time prophecies of your Bible. The coronavirus is hastening the arrival of this prophesied Holy Roman Empire. And just 6 months after that, or you can see how, I guess it's a bit longer than 6 months, but about half a year after that, you can see now Mario Draghi coming to power in Italy. This person that we've been watching for some time as a direct result of the economic fallout of the coronavirus and the pressure that that has put on the Italian government. And he himself could be significant. One of the things Mr. Flory then goes on to talk about in that article is how the coronavirus could trigger a massive economic crisis in Europe. He zeroes in on Italy as well and the disastrous economic situation that Italy is in, the danger that poses to the whole Eurozone, and how a crash in Italy could have seismic effects all around Europe. Just this would be something far bigger than Grexit, you know, Greece defying the euro or crashing out of the euro. So there's the potential now for that kind of a crisis. And what Mr. Flory talks about in this article is the Bible has a lot of very clear prophecies for Europe. It's a Europe that's led by the Catholic Church, and Mr. Draghi could play a role in that. It's a Europe that is ruled by 10 autocrats, 10 kings, not 27 Democrats. What takes Europe from there, you know, from here to there? It's got to be something pretty big to get Europe from to make that transformation. And he talks about how an economic crisis could play a role in that. He talks about other potential crises. And coronavirus has set the stage for so many of those potential crises. So we could see Europe, Italy just moving forwards now into this direction that helps lead to some pretty revolutionary events, and revolutionary events not just for Italy, but for all of the EU and all of the world.
Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire is the article we will link to in the show notes. We'll also put a link to that Ron Fraser article, Europe Enter the Dragon. Keep your eye on Italy. We appreciate you bringing that to us, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we'll look at Iran's latest development in its nuclear weapons program, a military coup in Myanmar, Germany building COVID detention camps, and one more really horrifying Biden policy. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The Iran nuclear program has been very active lately, increasing its uranium enrichment capability. This week it made another very relevant advancement. To learn about this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, on Monday, Iran tested a brand new rocket. This is the Zaljana rocket. It's 25 meters long, and it is one of the first that Iran has fired into space that uses solar propellant for its fuel. It can carry a 225 kilogram payload, so this is quite a lot. And what a lot of people are talking about related to this, and what is extremely important for us to recognize, is that similar technologies are shared to put a spacecraft into orbit, as is to create an intercontinental ballistic missile, one that can reach other far off places. And these missiles can be eventually they can hold a nuclear weapon. And so this has also always been part of Iran's strategy. It needs a nuclear weapon. It needs the uranium enriched to a certain degree. And then it needs the delivery mechanism to send it off to wherever it wants to hit. And so it has been continuing to develop its ability to send more weight into space and more weight into greater distances away from its territory. So this can carry, as I said, 225 kilograms. That's far more than some of the nuclear warheads that America has as far as the amount of weight that it needs. The thrust of this is 75 kilotons, which is far more than Iran needs to just launch a normal satellite into space. Obviously, they are upping that, the thrust ability, for something bigger. And so Carolyn Glick, Israeli commentator, wrote about this in her piece this week. And she says that this launch of a rocket that can be used for an ICBM, this has a range, if it's launched as a missile, of 5,000 kilometers. This is enough for Iran then to reach Britain from Iran. So all of Europe would be coming under Iran's potential nuclear umbrella, or areas it could hit with a nuclear weapon if they use the same technology.
Whenever this subject comes up, I have to think, when you're talking about missiles that have a range to reach European cities, that Europeans have to be very attentive to what's going on here. This just seems like the confrontation between Iran and Europe is absolutely inevitable at some point.
Yeah, it's definitely brewing. And what's interesting about this is because we know that Israel is the main enemy of Iran, or at least they state that. But Iran has had the ability to reach Israel with a missile, with a nuclear warhead, if they get that, a long time ago. And so why are they developing these missiles with such a great range? This is what Carolyn Glick wrote. She said it didn't spend $250 million, which was the cost of this program to develop this missile, on a rocket or missile that can hit Europe because it's scared. That is, Iran is scared of Israel and Saudi Arabia. It developed the Zoljana because it wants the capacity to attack Europe. Hmm. And it wants to attack Europe because it's revolutionary, rather than a status quo regime that seeks global domination, not regional stability. So she's correctly highlighting the fact that Iran wants this to target Europe. It does so because it's revolutionary and it believes that it's a global power and wants to have a global force. And that just falls right in line with biblical prophecy, and especially keynote prophecy in Daniel 11 and verse 40, which talks about radical Islamic power in Iran pushing geopolitically and really scaring Europe into a very frightful and rapid response to stop Iran from having its ability to hurt it. And when we see Iran developing that ability with a nuclear weapon, with shutting off, let's say, trade or something right, like that through holding sea gates, but actually getting the wherewithal to put a nuclear weapon into on the European continent, Europe has to be mad by this and certainly has to wake up to its dangers. Mm-hmm. And so we've got a trend article that shows that Europe will do exactly that. This trend article is entitled "Iran and Europe Heading for a Clash of Civilizations." And it goes through those prophecies about how Iran will push Europe to act forcefully against it.
We will link to that in the show notes. We also have an article that is slated to go up on the Trumpet site very soon. Iran flexes its space muscles with new rocket launch by Mihailo Zekic. You can watch for that on the website as well. Thank you for that, Brent. As bad as the political situation in America is right now, the Asian nation of Myanmar just experienced a full-out military coup. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, we don't often talk about Myanmar on the show, but this is a nation of 55 million people. That makes it the 26th most populous country. It also has the 38th most powerful military of any country. It's located right in between China and the Bay of Bengal, so it is an important country. And on Monday, its military carried out a coup and took power. So Myanmar actually has a long history of military rule, starting pretty much from the time it got its independence from Great Britain back in 1948. But the generals started to relax their grip back in 2015. They started to let the country become kind of a hybrid democracy. But as the years went by, the democratically elected leaders were getting more and more popular. And then in elections last November, the military-backed party won only 7% of the vote. So that seemed to be kind of a breaking point for the generals. And so on Monday, they staged a coup. It was a bloodless coup, but it did oust Aung San Suu Kyi, the de facto leader. And it's getting all kinds of condemnation. But this shows that Myanmar's little experiment with democracy is now over.
So the UN tried to jump on Myanmar for this taking place, but was stopped from doing so.
Yes. Yeah, they held a two-hour emergency meeting this week led by the UK. They were basically just calling for the junta to respect the rule of law and to immediately release those who were unlawfully detained. But you'll never guess which members of the UN Security Council decided to block this condemnation. And of course, I'm being sarcastic because we've all come to expect Russia and China to very often take a stance on the wrong side of these types of issues. And since they have veto power in the UN Security Council, they can prevent the organization from, you know, doing much good of any kind. All the British were asking for here was a statement, which basically wouldn't have done much anyway, mm-hmm. but the Russians and the Chinese denied it. So, you know, that makes it a very sad week for Aung San Suu Kyi and the people of Myanmar and democracy.
And it also really shows the fecklessness of the United Nations, as if we needed more illustration of that.
That's right, yes. And Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, he was the editor-in-chief of the Plain Truth magazine, the forerunner to the Trumpet, and he actually attended the inaugural session of the UN back in 1945. That's right when World War II was ending. And so many people were very optimistic about the United Nations being formed, that it would prevent the outbreak of another war, that it would bring peace to many peoples in the world. But Mr. Armstrong did not share in that optimism. After that meeting, he wrote, quote, "Already I see the clouds of World War III gathering at this conference." So, you know, he recognized even amid all that optimism that the UN would fail. And now we have 75 years of history to look back on. And there's just an endless list of situations like the one this week with Russia and China blocking the UN from, you know, condemning the Myanmar coup. And it all shows that Mr. Armstrong was exactly right and the UN will not save mankind.
Well, we do appreciate that. We have an article up at thetrumpet.com by Mihailo Zekic, Beijing's Burmese Days. He talks about this coup and a little bit more in terms of how this demonstrates China's power and how really he calls this what has happened here in Myanmar a small prize for China and helping its influence to skyrocket within that region. We also have a chapter in our He Was Right booklet about the UN and those statements that Herbert W. Armstrong made about that organization. So we'll link to both of those in the show notes for the program today. Thank you very much, Jeremiah. The construction of detention facilities in Germany raises alarming historical comparisons, but it is happening. To learn why, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yeah, so in the first half, we talked about this article from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry, Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire. And in that article, he was talking all about how coronavirus is changing Europe in important ways. We talked about the push towards a crisis. In that first half, another thing that Mr. Flurry really drew attention to in that article is this rise of authoritarianism, of big state power, things that would have been unthinkable this time last year before COVID kicked in. And we see an excellent example of that from the German state of Schleswig-Holstein, where they are opening COVID camps, detention centers, for those that the government says are not quarantining well enough, who are not sticking to the COVID-19 laws. They can be arrested and detained for the rest of their quarantine period in these camps. So this is generally people who have kind of been in contact with somebody who's suspected to have COVID. it's something that has a fair bit of popular support. You've got politicians talking about how stubborn quarantine breakers must be isolated. And we have an article on this on our website, COVID Jails in Germany. And one of the points that this article makes is, well, you know, we have broken a taboo here. Like I said, this is something that would have been unthinkable pre-pandemic. And now we're locking up not criminals, but putting people in here because we're in conditions that we would never think about doing so before. It's a small example in some ways. It's one German state, but yet another example of how COVID is changing Europe into something that is much darker, and in some ways, even in this example, authoritarian.
COVID Jails in Germany. We will link to that article in the show notes for today's program. Thank you very much, Richard. We'll finish with another story about the Biden administration's early decisions. So many of them have been about reversing the policies of Donald Trump. We'll look at one of those, you could say a good moral policy of President Trump that he abruptly changed. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, many Canadians were upset by Joe Biden's decision to cancel the Keystone Pipeline, but he did make one executive order that has the Trudeau government in Canada very happy. On January 28th, they cheered a policy that Biden enacted allowing the U.S. government to start funding abortions around the world again. Like you said, this has been a long-standing back-and-forth legal battle in America. In 1985, President Ronald Reagan put a ban on federal groups funding nonprofit organizations around the world that support abortion. And in the years since then, Democratic presidents have rescinded this ban, and Republican presidents have restored it at least five times. This is the latest with President Trump restoring President Reagan's policy and now Joe Biden bringing it back with the moral support of Canadians, allowing the American government to fund abortions and the groups that support abortions in third world countries and African countries, just trying to expand this this sin to as many nations as possible. And it does remind you of the verse in Ezekiel 5:7, where God says, referring to the nations of Israel, "You have multiplied your disobedience more than the nations that are around you." So it's like, not only are you aborting your children by the millions, you actually have government programs used to fund other nations that aren't doing that and help them do it more. So really just a despicable policy. In the show notes, we can put, "Is Abortion Really Murder?" By Fred Dadlow, for any of our readers to really want to see what God says on that topic.
Well, we will link to that, and we'll also link to our trend article, Moral Decline in Britain and America, and why the Trumpet watches that trend. We thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that is it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to these fine gentlemen, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of G.K. Chesterton. "Thanks are the highest form of thought, and gratitude is happiness doubled by wonder." Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
To Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.